policies. So this is, as I said at the beginning of our discussion, this is a field of struggle. Let's struggle to change the Democratic Party. That's the only way next year and in 2028 to defeat this fascistic Republican Party.
Norm Salmon, we thank you for being with us, director of Roots Action, author of the new book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy. And we'll link to your piece in Common Dreams and The Guardian. That ends it for our show. Happy birthday to Dennis McCormick. Happy News Year. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
WRHU, Hempstead Radio Hofstra University. 88.1 FM, WCWP Brookville LIU Post. 88.3 FM, WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University. 88.3 FM, WVCR Loudonville Siena College. 98.1 and 105.9 FM, WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Mahwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
Must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by. Feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. 88.3 WRCT Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, and 89.5 FM Bush Radio Cape Town, South Africa, the mother of community radio. You're listening to the One World Community Radio Show. I'm Ricky Hubert, broadcasting in New York, and we are honored to be joined by Linda Beagle Shulman today from the Scott J. Beagle Memorial Fund. Linda, thank you so much for coming on and joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, Linda, before we get into everything, we mentioned the Scott J. Beagle Memorial Fund. If you could tell people a little bit more about what the fund is and how it came to be. It's a very sad story, but if you could tell people about it, that'd be great.
It's a sad story, but it's a happy ending. My son, Scott Beagle, was the teacher and cross-country coach who was murdered in the Parkland shooting February 14, 2018, Valentine's Day. What happened at the time was there was a shooter who came into the building. Scott was teaching. It was the last class of the day. Scott's class was on the third floor. The shooter came in and murdered a ridiculous amount of people on the first floor. The second floor knew it was gunfire, so they were all in their safe places when the murderers, right now he's the murderer. At that time, they would just call him the shooter, went on to the second floor, and everybody was in their safe places, so he did not fire and murder on the second floor. He saw no one in the classrooms. But on the third floor, they did not know that it was shots that were being fired. They thought it was a fire drill because the residue from the AR-15 being shot triggered the fire alarms. The dust triggered the fire alarms. So all of the children and teachers and staff on the third floor thought it was a fire drill. So you can imagine the chaos with the kids getting out of their classrooms thinking it was a fire drill and going down to the exits on the sides of that floor trying to get out, because on a fire drill, that's what you do. But then when they realized that it was gunshots, they were summoning everybody back and forth to get back into the classrooms, and there was total chaos. Scott was in his class, and protocol would have it that he would lock his door, go into his safe place in his classroom. Scott went against protocol, opened his classroom door, summoned in as many of his students as he could get in. From what I was told, there were 31 students that he saved. And when he went to then close his classroom door, the shooter was coming up to the third floor and shot him 6 times within 3 seconds from 5 feet away. And that's at that point, 2 days after the murder, I said to my husband at that time that I wanted to make sure we did 2 things. I'm pretty sure I was probably still in denial and maybe in shock. But I definitely told Michael, I said to him, we're going to do 2 things, just like that. We're going to do 2 things. I said, we're going to start a fund in Scott's name, and we're going to get legislation written in Scott's name. So my husband said to me, the fund will be able to do the legislation. We'll work on. Anyway, that's how the Scott J. Beagle Memorial Fund came about. Scott was the teacher and cross-country coach at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. He loved children. He loved mentoring children. He loved working with children. He loved being able to impact on children's lives. And then just to digress a little bit, for 2 months of Scott's life, he went to South Africa and he taught. And he taught in, I don't remember the name of the school, but he taught for 2 months. And when he came home from there, he had no suitcases with him. And me being the mom, I was like, oh my God, you're gone for 2 months already. And the airlines lost your suitcase. And he said, Mom, no. He said, Mom, here they pray for snow days. There they bang on the bars wanting to get into school. Here, they're worried about if they have the most modern style of Nikes, sneakers, whatever. Over there, they're happy to have shoes. He said, Mom, I just left all my stuff there. So when you take his experiences of working with the less fortunate and his experiences in school teaching geography and cross-country coaching, I decided that what we would do is the mission of the fund would be to send at-risk, underserved children touched by gun violence, impacted by gun violence, to summer sleepaway camp. And that's what we do. I'm very proud of our mission, and I'm very proud of the people who work on our fund and everybody who's helped us, because we decided it would never be a one-off. We would continue. We would send children to sleepaway camp from the age of 7 and 8, because that's when Scott went to sleepaway camp. That was Scott's very favorite place, was at summer sleepaway camp. He could leave everything behind and just be a kid. And he went from the age of 7 to till he was murdered for 28 years. And so we took those camp experiences that he was so fond of and teaching the less fortunate. And that's how we came up with the Scott J. Beagle Memorial Fund. The first year we sent 54 children to camp. It's $1,500 to send one child to camp for 2 weeks. The second year we took the same 54, give or take, because there were some rules, you had to stay out of trouble, so on and so forth. We sent the same 54, we added to it, we sent 165. The following year, we added to the 165, those same children, and we got to 212. Then we had the pandemic, and the fund sent a $25,000 grant to one of our seven camps, and we had virtual camp. And then from the 212, we went to 264 and 266. That's where we are today. It's definitely in Scott's honor, but the way Scott would say it, it's all about the kids.
You were saying about Scott, it's all about the kids. And you told us a little bit about Scott with teaching and South Africa and those things. Tell us a little bit more about Scott, the person, and what he kind of stood for. What was Scott all about?
Oh, Scott was probably one of the most humble people you've ever known or ever met. He had very dry, sarcastic humor. He was fun to be around. And if you were his friend, he was all in. He'd give you the shirt off his back. Scott loved mentoring. And, you know, I always say Scott liked to live life with Scott rules. For an example, one of his first teaching jobs was in a very well-known school in Florida. I'll leave all the names out. And everybody was like, wow, Scott, it's amazing that you got this job. It's such a great school, blah, blah, blah. Very high class school, private school. And he taught there. And at the end of the school year, when he was given the contract for the following year, he said, no, I'm not going to accept the contract. I'm not going to sign it. And everybody around him was like, are you crazy? You know, I know it was your first job. You don't understand. And he said, no, they won't let me teach the way I want to teach. He said, I have to go very strictly according to the syllabus. He said, when the vice principal would come in to observe, she would never even wait till the end of the period that I was teaching. And then I would go and we would talk about, you know, what she had seen. And I asked why you didn't stay to the end. And she would say, because you did not teach the way you were supposed to be teaching that class. And he said, but if you would have waited to the end, you would have seen that all the kids grasped what I was teaching. And so that led him to want to find a school to teach where they gave him, you know, the syllabus of what he had to teach the kids, but he could do it his way. That was Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. And I give you an example of teaching the way Scott wanted to teach. After the mass shooting, one of his students, names I will leave out again, called me and said to me, we're doing a choral concert and my song is in honor of Scott. Would you like to attend? And I said, I would love to. And we went and they called us out and, you know, we were thankful to be there and we thanked everybody for, you know, for their thoughts and their prayers and also their help. And all of a sudden I got a tap on my shoulder from someone behind me. And it was a woman with a very huge Irish accent. And I'm not going to try to even portray that. But she said to me, I never met your son, but I love him. And I said, okay, I'll bite. And I said, why? And she went into explaining that Scott had given assignment to his class that they had to find someone, family, friend, or someone that lived outside the country, whatever country they chose, and learn all about them, and then come back. He gave them a time limit and give a report on it. And she said, and my granddaughter was beside herself. It's something she didn't want to do. The kids were very unhappy about it. But they'd had to do the assignment, and they did. And she said, and look at me, here I am now in the United States. She said, when your son first gave the assignment, if I spoke to my granddaughter four times a year, it was a lot. She said, but because of the assignment, we had to Skype at least 4 days a week. She said, and now I speak to my granddaughter at least 3 and 4 times a week on Skype. And look, I'm here. I'm here sitting, you know, watching her in her program. And that was Scott. That's how Scott taught. It wasn't out of a notebook. He hated learning from a notebook. And so he wanted them to have the experience. And that's what he did.
So now, ever since you guys started the fund because of the incident that happened years ago, so I want to know now, in terms of as people that started this fund and also advocating for people's safety, especially when it comes to guns, what do you think of America's policies when it comes to things like guns? I know that with USA, it's in the Constitution, you know, you have a right to arm yourself, to protect yourself and all that. But how has that been like, especially with now with mass shootings that has happened in the past throughout the country? But how as a movement that is advocating for peace and safety, especially for students, how are you satisfied with how now the government is progressing, especially when it comes to safety with guns?
No, I am very disappointed. It is a tremendous uphill climb. And from the very day that Scott was murdered, I have been fighting and fighting and fighting for reasonable gun safety. To me, and to many people, more people, it's the government we're really fighting, because it's common sense. When I speak, wherever I speak, whether it's an auditorium in a college, and I've spoken at Hofstra, or whether it's a group of 12 people, I ask two questions. I ask, do you want to be safe? And do you want to live without fear? Nobody answers no. It's common sense. But we are fighting a group. Obviously, you know, the NRA, they're a big group with a lot of money behind them. And the money seems to be what's talking. They're all about guns. And I think they just take the people who dig in, okay, they just take that Second Amendment and they twist it and turn it for their own good. But really, it should, all of us who are fighting, we don't want to take away the guns, we say, but it's about communities being safe. And with all the guns that are out there, and the more and more and more, the safety becomes less and less. So no, I'm not satisfied. I'm devastated. And what's happening in the United States, and I'm sorry to have to say this, is now the shootings are becoming commonplace. It used to be there was a shooting and we heard about it for weeks and weeks and tried to do whatever we can do. And now when there's a shooting, they talk about it for the day. And the next day, whatever makes better news, they go on to that. I'm very unhappy, and I will continue to fight, Kusi, for the rest of my life for gun safety. It's not gun control. As you know, words make a big difference. It's gun safety. And even people who own guns, I'm not looking to take them away. As long as they own them legally and they've done background checks, if they secure them safely, that's okay. But it is not okay the way the United States have it. I mean, there are some states that you just go into a store, you buy a gun. There are more guns in the United States than people.
And now, coming back to the fund, how has the fund throughout the years since it started has been helping out? And what has the fund been used for?
Well, the fund sends at-risk, underserved children impacted by gun violence to summer sleepaway camp. The premise is that when we take these children, okay, from communities that are riddled with guns and gangs, and we take these children and take them to a safe place, for summer sleepaway camp for 2 weeks, they can take a big deep breath. They know they're going to be safe. They don't have to live with fear. Okay, they learn how to trust. They do things they could never do in their communities. They learn swimming. They can go boating. They do arts and crafts. There are horses. They have gardens, vegetable gardens. They get to leave the world behind and just be kids. And that's what Scott got to do. He went to camp, I was saying before, since he's seven, and that was his happy place. And so we're trying to take these children, and as I said to Ricky, it's not just one summer. We try to take the children from when they're 8 years old, okay, for the next 10 years till when they're 16, they become counselors in training. They pay it forward. And then 17, they become counselors. And then we have a career, you know, career opportunity days. But the premise is to take these children and show them there's a better way. We call it prehabilitation, so that we work with them when they're young and keep them from guns and gangs, so later in life we don't have to do rehabilitation when they get caught up in the justice system.
Linda, how many years have you been doing the CAB?
It's going to be 7 years. This will be the seventh year, because it's going to be
right, 7 years.
8 years since Scott was murdered. So this is like the seventh year.
And so the kids were 7, 8 now. The kids are like 14, 15 now.
Yes, and...
Yes. You keep in touch? What is the shift you've seen in them?
Yes, I do keep in touch. I go back to visit this camps. This is the first year I didn't visit all, but I go back to visit the camps every summer. And you know that at this point, the kids know me. You know, it's, oh, hi, Miss Linda. Hi, Miss. I know the children. I have lunch with them. I talk with them. One young lady came up to me to tell me, because of the career opportunity days, we had Northwell go a couple of years ago where we had roundtables. We had, actually this year, we had one of the judges here from Nassau County bring colleagues, and we have roundtables with the older campers. The one young lady came up to me at one of the galas and said to me, you know, because of Northwell, I'm going into nursing. And we help these children. We help them with resumes, the camps do, and learning how to interview. And many, many of them go off to college, and then some of the camps, they have some of the camp that started as campers on the board of directors now. So, you know, we try to change their lives. And I think that in almost all the cases we do, the children don't want to go home. They just don't want to go home from camp.
So you have these young kids, serving on the board?
Yeah, what happens was we started sending kids from when they were 8. But some of the children that we sent started later. So what happens was, let's face it, they get to be 17 and they become counselors. They go off to college. Okay. And in those years on a board, and we were talking about this earlier, Ricky, if you have the experience of before you got your job, if you, these children went to summer sleepaway camp, they had that experience of being nurtured and learning and interacting with people from all different ethnicities. That's a hard word for me. And now we're taking them and they're on the board of directors working with people who are on the board older, and that's how you get it going, keeping up with the times and learning about what younger people's needs are. And these people, these kids who are now on the board have gone through the system of camp.
So Linda, you know, with the gun violence in the US, it's there, it's visible, it's been recorded throughout the years. I want to know though, you know, as now you guys with the fund and also highlighting the issues that are being faced, especially when it comes to the safety of guns, I want to know, has US ever had something like a national dialogue where throughout the country, maybe the government or organizations, you know, talk about the issue of guns, how it affects an ordinary citizens, especially young people who sometimes if they get angry or bullied, then they end up, you know, doing mass shooting. Has there ever been a dialogue, especially to ordinary Americans?
Kusi, the dialogue is ongoing and ongoing and ongoing. But when you have a government, okay, that has dug in their heels, I'm sure you understand, has dug in their heels and will not even, they hear you, but they're not listening. They hear what you're saying, but it doesn't matter. My opinion, this is all my opinion. It has a lot to do with money. okay? Unless they do campaign finance reform where everybody gets the same. If you're running for Senate, you get this amount. If you're running for Congress, you get this amount. If you're running for vice president, you get this again. Until they do that, and it's certainly not going to be anytime soon because they don't even want to hear about it, okay? We're not going to be able to fix this. We keep speaking. We have dialogues. We've spoken wherever you can speak. We have groups like Moms Demand Action. We have Every Town. We have all the groups speaking and speaking and talking. But you can speak to someone. I mean, I know I can speak to someone and they can agree with me and agree with me and agree with me. And then I say, you know, when it comes to voting, what the candidate stands for gun safety, they say yes, 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 and then they go to the booth and then they don't, and they vote, they don't vote the way they vote a different way. There are people who are just dug in. I was just on, I don't know what you call it. I zoomed into a meeting that they had in Arizona. It was amazing. It was a women's group, Women Talk. It was just an amazing experience. But the two other people who spoke besides me, one was an attorney who was all about the Second Amendment, you know, the Second Amendment going all the way back to the 1800s, not even opening his mind to today. Back then you can't have a bazooka today, and back then the times were really very different, and these people don't seem to. And then there was a professor on there who also, both people were very, very smart, but this professor was talking about the Constitution and you know what, today in America everybody's scratching their head wondering, you know, what is going on? We have a Constitution, are we following it? It depends upon who is running the government, and I don't want to get into a political. The fund never ever dabbles in politics. Okay, we're a 501(c), and politics is never in there. Gun safety is in there, but politics is not. And you ask the question, and there have been dialogues all over. But it to some people, it just goes in one ear and out the other. And the only thing that seems to change people's minds is when it touches them personally. And that's very sad. You know, it's very sad. When it touches them personally and they honestly live it, all of a sudden, you know, it's important to have a red flag law. Red flag law is one of them. I fight for it all the time. We have it in New York. Where I am in New York, we have the strictest gun safety legislation there is. My son has one in his name, the Scott J. Beagle Unfinished Receiver Act, because I'm not sure if you know, but ghost guns, I can't even believe that there's such a thing that can exist. I don't know, Kusi, if you know what that is, a ghost gun?
No, I don't know. Please, can you educate me more on that?
Oh, sure. Are you sitting down? Because your hair's going to stand up, okay? A ghost gun, you can go online any day. Say you go online on Monday. By Tuesday night, Wednesday, they send you the parts. There are very few parts to put together a gun that works. You get your package in the mail, and it used to be like $800. It's way less. It's like, I believe it's less than $500. All the parts come in the mail. You need a drill, and you don't have to be a carpenter. You can be a layman like me, a drill, a normal drill. You drill three holes, you put it together, and if you're not sure, you can go on YouTube. It comes with instructions, and you can go on YouTube, and within no time, you put it together, and you have a functionally working gun. It has no serial number, and it can't be traced. So I ask everybody when we talk about it, and you talk about speaking to the government, I'll tell you what I did. But you tell me anything in life that doesn't have a serial number. We have serial numbers. I can talk about the United States. We have social security numbers. Anything that we buy in the store has a number on it. Your car has a serial number on it. Everything. But this weapon, this gun that can kill people, would have no serial number. And you ask about the government. When we wanted to pass legislation, we found that the only thing we could do to make any sense is to ask the Senate, okay, in the Assembly in New York, to go on a Zoom with us. We shamed them into it. Almost everyone went on the Zoom. We actually showed them, one of my friends and myself, how to put together a ghost gun and how easy it is to put together. And I want you to know, I call it show and tell, and that's how we got the law passed, the legislation for ghost guns being banned in New York. That's how we did it. And if I may take a couple more minutes to explain something else. In the United States, again, I can talk about the United States, many, many years ago when I was young, and I'm old, so it was a lot of years ago, smoking, the tobacco industry, smoking was the same way as guns all over the place. Everybody smoked. Anybody and everybody smoked. And then doctors were showing statistics and talking about how bad smoking is to you. Finally, someone had the guts to show what smoking does. And they went on to the TV and they show there are a good amount of commercials with people if you not breathing, how hard it is to breathe, how if you want to do Thanksgiving, you better start in September because it's so hard. And they actually showed actual people what it does. In my opinion, until we get on the TV the same way and we get on social media and we show what an AR-15 or what that does when you're shot and what it does to you and how it goes into your body, a small bullet, and explodes in your body, and you can't use it for hunting because if you shoot a deer or whatever you're going to shoot, you have no carcass left because the velocity of the bullet explodes inside of the body of whatever it hits. Until we do show and tell, Kusi, we're not going to be able to get the guns eliminated off the streets. We're just not going to be able to do it because people are today hearing words. Okay, it's just words. Oh, there was just another mass shooting. And then the media goes on to the next thing that makes the news. So I apologize for my passion, but it's literally, it's ingrained in me. I saw my son when he was dead on the floor. I saw my son when they did I saw the autopsy. I saw all the parts. So you're asking, yes, we have been doing all we can, but the problem is we have two sides. And one of the sides who sides, and they hide behind the Second Amendment. They're all for the NRA because the NRA has so much money and gives money to the politicians. And you know, that's where we are. So I'm sorry for going on and on, but I am passionate when it comes to gun safety.
So now I know, Linda, I might ask a little bit of a sensitive question here. So now, as a parent losing a loved one in such way, how long did it took you to heal, even though you're still advocating for it now? But how long did it took you to be where you are now, so passionate in the terms of you don't want the same thing to happen to other families that are out there in the world?
I'm never going to heal. So how long it took me to heal, I'm never going to heal. Never. It took me 2 days. I was devastated. I was heartbroken. I'm still heartbroken. It took me 2 days. I think my way of grieving and I think my way of mourning was, I'm not sure what the definition of mourning is, but I think my way of mourning was to do like Scott did. Scott went against everything that he was supposed to do and saved children because that was so important and saved lives, okay? And I believe that that's my mission as well. And I'm not trying to sound like, you know, anything great because I'm just me. But I really believe that if, I'll give you an example, if I know for a fact, if the red flag law, if legislation were passed in Florida for the red flag law, which stops the tragedy before it happens, I would have my son with me this Thanksgiving and all of those 17 other children and staff would be alive today. So I'm just not a person who said, you know, if then, It's now. And so it took me 2 days, just 2 days, to start advocating, and I will never stop advocating. Now, you ask about healing. I don't know. I don't know that I'm ever going to heal. I say when someone asks me that, I have a box over my heart. I have a small box over my heart. Every once in a while, the lid comes out, because those are my emotions. That if I have to put one foot in front of the other, I have to put those emotions aside. And every once in a while, that lid opens and I the tears come to my eyes. But I keep it closed the best I can, and it's always there. And Scott's always with me. But like I would give you an example. I know the holidays are coming up. For me, the hardest day is not the holidays. It's Scott's birthday. That's the hardest day for me. Scott's birthday was October 22nd, and he would have been 43. He was murdered at 35. And that's the hardest day for me. My daughter, Melissa, was born on Valentine's Day, and Scott was murdered on Valentine's Day. It's the best day of my life and the worst day of my life. So we don't celebrate Valentine's Day, but we do celebrate Melissa's birthday. It took 2 years to convince her that we will celebrate her birthday. But I will not celebrate what people call an anniversary, and it's not an anniversary. An anniversary is a good thing. It's not an anniversary of the shooting. It's a memorial of the shooting. But like, for instance, I started saying for Thanksgiving, Scott, no matter where my children or grandchildren or family were, it didn't matter. They were at my house on Thanksgiving. It's my favorite holiday. It's not religious, and anybody could come. And I used to say to them, anybody who doesn't have a place, come to my house. I have food. Doesn't matter if you cook for one, you cook for a million. Okay. And so we celebrated. But the first first Thanksgiving after Scott was murdered, I decided that I could not see an empty chair at the table. I mean, Scott was 35 years old. So for 35 years on Thanksgiving, he was at my table, even when he was like a little tyke in a little, you know, car seat or something that we would put near the table. So what I do is I cook on Thursday, Thanksgiving, and I have Thanksgiving on Friday. And it works for me because my family is off on Friday. They're lucky. The people who come to Thanksgiving on Friday, obviously, they either come after work, you know, come for the afternoon. And that's how I get through Thanksgiving. But holidays are tough. And you know, it's a reflection day, you know, for everybody who loses a loved one, or even if they don't lose a loved one to gun violence, it's still a reflection day for a loved one when a loved one passes. Yeah, it's hard. But as far as getting past it or healing, I guess you heal because you have no choice. Getting past it, you do, but it's always there, especially when it's something as devastating as gun violence, because it's not like your loved one was sick, you know, and they had an ailment or something. It's like, bang, right out of the clear blue sky.
Just while we have you here, Linda. We were talking about the holidays, talking about birthdays. I mean, you were saying not even just to gun violence. There's a lot of people, too many people. No one should have to bury a child, first and foremost. But there's just so much. What kind of, not even like advice, I don't even know what you would call it, for people who have buried children and are going through their first holiday festive season without them, first birthday, first anything. What kind of, I guess for lack of a better term, advice would you give to those people as we're heading into the November and December months?
I say make sure you surround yourself with people that you want to be with, not that you have to be with. Surround yourself with people who love you and understand. Reflect. Everybody has to reflect. I mean, we're only human. You have to reflect. I don't know, it's so hard to put into words. Just don't be by yourself. I know, my husband passed away. He had a stroke, and Michael passed away August 27th, 2024. Don't let yourself be alone, because I think that's the worst. Talk about it. I love to talk about Scott. To me, when somebody says, you know, I don't know if this will upset you, but, and they tell me a Scott story, you know, somebody calls me and tells me, oh, I remember something from camp, or they send photos. I love it. To me, that's like the greatest thing. It brings a smile to my face, and I like to remember. Okay. I said, and I try to live by it, and so far so good, is I will not mourn Scott's death. I will celebrate his life. And that might sound like pie in the sky, but I heard myself say it at his funeral, and those words stuck with me, and I try to do that. I love thinking about all the good times that we had. It took me a really long time to get out of my mind and out of, you know, seeing Scott dead. Okay, that was a horrible picture that I had to get rid of, but in my head. But share with people about it, you know, look at photos and talk to people about it. Don't keep it in. Keeping it in, I did it for a long time. Keeping it in is not good. It's like toxic. So I love to talk about Scott, and I will tell you, be mindful, because people on social media, whatever it is, there are always, and they mean it from the bottom of their hearts, but it's always, I know you're sad on Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever you celebrate, you know, Kwanzaa, I know you're sad, or on Scott's birthday, I know this is a hard day. At one point you say to yourself, especially texting, you say to yourself, oh my God, just leave me alone. But you have to remember that they're doing it because they care, but it's tough. Really, as far as the holiday comes, like I said, I like to celebrate on Friday because I don't like that empty seat at my table. Surround yourself with people that care for you. Just do that. I think that's really important. Please don't be by yourself. Don't be by yourself.
I don't think it's a strange question, but something I know that a lot of people who have had losses have gone through. Do you ever feel Scott's presence in your life?
Oh, yeah, I do. That's not a strange question. That's an amazing question. I'm not a believer in all that stuff. You know, I'm not a believer. Okay. And I do believe that there are signs, and I didn't know it before. It's going to sound crazy, and I'm really not crazy, but maybe a little. What happened was, the first year that we send kids to camp, well, actually it goes back before that. After the murders of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, different organizations did things for the community in honor of each of the different 17 people who were murdered. And for Scott, we refurbished a playground that was for children, you know, after school. They went to the playground, underprivileged children that went to this playground, and the playground was really nasty. And we refurbished it. We painted and we planted and we did all sorts of stuff. We spent an entire day there, and anybody who wanted a volunteer to come, it was a great day. And this monarch butterfly was there the entire day. Wherever we were, the monarch butterfly was flying around, and I thought nothing of it. The summer after that, I visited. At that time, it was only three camps. We started with three camps. I visited all three camps. And every time I went up to the camp, whatever camp I was at, there was a monarch butterfly. And monarch butterflies are kind of rare if you do a little research on them here, okay? So I started thinking, wow, that's very strange. Maybe that's a sign. Maybe it's Scott. Maybe there's some sort of, I don't know. Then Scott was a runner. I can't run, but Scott would say, we had a 3.5 mile, we had a route that we would do when Scott would come home from Florida. We had this 3.5 mile route where he would jog because I couldn't run, and I would walk as fast as I could to his slow jog. And so that being said, I tried to do that. And that was a hard thing for me in the beginning to do it without Scott. But I would do it. And as I was coming around to go home, I remember saying it was not a good day. I was not having a good day. And I was talking to whom the air. And I was like, you know, this isn't what I want. This is it. This is not what I want to be doing today. And, you know, they should at least give me a sign, thinking about this monarch butterfly stuff. You should at least give me a sign because I'm doing it. I know you tell me I should do it. I don't want to do it. I'm miserable, blah, 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 blah. And as I'm turning the corner to come into my house, this monarch butterfly appears. And I was like, as I was turning into my driveway, there it was. But what made me believe, and I am a believer, and anyone who wants to contact me to see, I'll show you. It was 11:15 at night, and I was taking my dog out, and we were going into the backyard. 11:15 at night, and there's a light is right above the window of Scott's room. It's one of those photosensitive lights so that, you know, when it's dark outside, it lights up the backyard. Michael said to me, Linda, look up. Now, anybody who knows anything, monarch butterflies do not come out at night. They do not. There was a monarch butterfly at Scott's window, and we were there for a good 10 minutes looking. That butterfly stayed there till we went into the house and left. I tell you, I'm sure you think I'm crazy. I honestly believe the monarch butterfly is a sign of Scott. It's just a sign of Scott telling me, Mom, it's okay.
Linda, 2025 is almost over. How's it been like for you and the Memorial Foundation?
It's tough without Mike. We were a puzzle. He did his share, I did mine. And when you put the two puzzle pieces together, we were very successful. Mike was great at going out and getting the money donations. He was very good at that. And I could do the in-kind donations. Like I get 40 boxes of 250 pair of Bombas socks every year. People have given me to give out to all of the campers. People have given me computers. We've started computer centers at the camp. Remember, these are all nonprofit camps, that the seven camps that we send our children to. And then people have given me collaborate with book fairs. We've started libraries at the camps where the kids can take home books. I'm good at that part. So when you put it together, it was great. I'm having a very difficult time now. And we have events. We've had Remembering Scott. We had a Scott J. Beagle Golf Classic. We've had Bark for Beagle, where a dog walk was really fun. People came out with their dogs to walk. We've had Run for Beagle every year. We've had a lot of events. And to run the events, it takes money to run the events. So it's very difficult getting the funding. And now with the government in the United States now, getting government funding is even going to be harder, because in the past, we've got a lot of government grants because they believe in what we do. You know, when you explain to someone what we do, they believe. So right now, myself, and I have a board, but right now myself, it's more than a full-time job, and it's very difficult. I say to anyone, I don't care if you send me $5. I don't care if you send me $5,000, okay, for 25, or whatever denomination. Send something. It's great. I have some people that signed in that every month automatically $10 is sent to Act Blue for the fund. It all adds up, and it takes a lot of money. It takes $1,500 is a lot of money to send a child to camp. And I'll do whatever I have to do to keep it going, but I do need help. And it looks like with the government that we have now, it's going to be a very, very tough time in 2026 to get funds to help. And by the way, if I may, Ricky, SJBMF.org, okay, you know, www.SJBMF, Scott J. Beagle Memorial Fund, SJBMF.org. Even if you don't want to send anything, I ask you to go to the site, because I'm very proud of the site, and it's all about Scott, and you can read all about what we do and all about my son. So again, even if you don't want to donate, I'm asking anybody out there who's listening to go to sjbmf.org and help me be proud of what we do.
And Linda, just before we head out now, the motto of your organization is changing the world one child at a time.
Yes.
If there's there's a million things we talked about, but if there's any one takeaway you want people to have from our conversation today, what is it?
It is. We are changing the world one child at a time, because look at the world we have, and we have children being born into this world and growing up. And if we can change one child at a time, the world is going to be a better place. So, yes, our motto is changing the world one child at a time. And that is truly what we do.
And once again, if you want to describe where people can find you, people can find out more about the advocacy. You mentioned the website. Where else can people turn to? You can mention the website again, too.
You know, sjbmf.org. All my information is there. I mean, you'll see all about it. My information is there if you want to contact me. But just make sure in the subject area, you know, that you write so that I understand I should open it, because of all the hacking today, it's a little scary. But anybody who wants to contact me, feel free, and we can go from there. I'm not a big advocate of Facebook. The only time I go to Facebook really is to put something up that the fund is doing. You know, I'm very careful. And Scott has a Facebook page as well. If you on Facebook, Scott, I believe it's Scott J. Beagle Memorial Fund has a Facebook page as well. You can find out all that information. Anybody who is on with us today, I thank you for tuning in and letting me talk about my son and letting me share with you my journey that's going to keep going. And I am sorry anybody who's on here who has experienced the loss of not only a child, but the loss of someone to violence with guns. I'm sorry for you, and we will keep fighting for everyone.
Linda, thank you very much for sharing your story. I know it's hard, even us, like asking some of these questions, we're trying to hold back, but we have to, as you also advocating for the next generation not to be fall victims into violence or gun violence. Thank you very much for having time to speak to us.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank Ricky so much for having me. And thank everybody out there for listening.
We thank you for coming on, Linda. We thank you so much. And we thank you for all the work that you're doing. You've been listening to the One World Community Radio Show on 88.7 FM, WRHU, Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York, 88.3 WRCT, Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, 89.5 FM, Bush Radio, the mother of community radio in Cape Town, South Africa. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to One World Radio, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU, Radio Hofstra University, Hempstead, New York. We thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you next week as we celebrate the power of radio in our one world. Tot ziens, jylle.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town, is host me, Lydia Mahwanana, broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
Sound FM, WRHU, Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York, 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, the mother of community radio at 88.3 WRCT, Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh. You are listening to the One World Community Radio Show. I'm Ricky Hubert in New York, and we are thrilled to have a very important topic being discussed on this show today, which is the cultural heritage of Ukraine. And we are thrilled to be joined by our two guests. If our guests would like to introduce themselves, Irina, we'll start with you.
Thank you. My name is Irina Forestian. I am a fundator of nonprofit organization Fund Frog, which is major meaning of this organization is save a cultural historical heritage. Most of them it's Ukraine heritage, but we are do research with other beautiful cultural heritage other nation. And I am volunteer from 2014 for Ukraine, as we have a, as you know, we have a hard time, and I involve in any many safe cultural project.
And Dr. Anne Feuerbach, you can introduce yourself.
Yes, I'm Dr. Anne Feuerbach. I'm a professor of archaeological science. I teach over at SUNY Ness Community College full-time, and I'm an adjunct in the anthropology department at Hofstra University. I met Irina in 2014 when she invited me, well, met her a few years before, but then she invited me over to Ukraine. We were there for a conference, and unfortunately, that's when the revolution broke out. And then I returned with her on numerous occasions to help work with museum professionals and help with the research on ancient Ukraine and preserving the cultural heritage.
Now, a big topic we're going to discuss today is FROC, which is the Foundation for Research for Ancient Civilizations, and specifically the work with Ukraine. How did both of you get involved with the organization? I think, Dr. Ann, you kind of answered that a little bit. But, Irina, we'll start with you because this is a really big passion of yours. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, from 2008. And of course, my passion to history, actually, first with my nation, I'm original from Ukraine. I'm here in America for 30 years. Always interest what kind of people live in my land and this land when I live now. What culture was, what the beliefs was. The influence our path is very strong for our life today. It's like a mirror for future, and people who deeply understand historical process like Dr. Feuerbach can predict or see the picture of our future, and they help to understand the process, those turbulence process what we watch now around the world. And 2008, I registered nonprofit organization, and we start do exhibit, conference, masterclass, meeting, everything what can present a very old and very rich historical and cultural heritage of Ukraine here in America, how we have connection, how it's very interesting how different nation with a different culture has a big connection, deep connection for many, many thousand years. We was happy to organize many exhibit, many conference. There was very special exhibit 2010 in a Ukraine Institute of America, actually across the Metropolitan Museum, which us was working 13 years. There was very special event. And we have we was happy to have invitation to United Nations. This time was celebration independent of Ukraine, and we have very honoring guest, and we was happy to present Pillion, which is Bronze Age 7-8,000 years history. So that was very special event. From 2014, we are be a part of this historical event in Ukraine, the movement for freedom, for independence, and our war actually never stopped for almost 1,000 years with this crazy neighborhood. And our military event started 2014 during conference. Like Dr. Feuerbach mentioned, 2014, it was very nice event about arm and armory, which was very echoed to situation in Ukraine. We start involved in this process. And the more and more I understand that it's very important to know our history, because the nation who knows own history, they know how to defend themselves, they know how to see the future of themselves. And those people, those Russians, a majority of Russians, they has no.
You're listening to An Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM over the airwaves in the city of Pittsburgh, streaming online to the world, up on WRCT.org. WRCT is supported by Speck Brothers Pizza, located at 5106.